In an ever-changing world, Conscious Co-Creation Productions presents A Voice of Truth, resonating a vibration of love and understanding, illuminating new paths for new directions as we, as one, strive for higher and higher planes of existence. Always remembering, life changes. This is radio like you have never felt before. Life Changes with Filippo. And now, your host, Filippo Voltaggio.
Ciao, everyone. I hope everybody has had a great week. Mine has been very exciting. It's exciting here at Life Changes with Filippo. I keep saying that the show should be called Life Changes for Filippo because it seems that, because my life is changing. just this week, I had the opportunity of going to see one of our past guests, Dr. Ken Best, and he did some work on me. And on that very day, our current guest, Johnny Seitz, was available to meet with me and show me a little bit about what he does before we got on the radio together. And I saw him immediately after, and boy, I tell you, my head was spinning by the end of the day. And I was thinking, I'm really living the life I want to be living. I'm really enjoying this. And each step of the way, it's not work, it's fun, it's I'm happy, it's my passion, and I'm just doing my thing. And it's interesting because this weekend I got interviewed for the Amici magazine, which is a Chicago-based magazine, which is nationwide for the Italian-American community, but for all communities because they have some great bios in there and great pictures and some great stories. And so I've been a fan of the magazine for quite a while. They've actually put me on for other shows and for my singing in the past. And this time they're putting me on for the show Life Changes with Filippo. And so I thought, wow, what's going to be the Italian twist on this one? And the interviewer started to ask me questions, and we just started talking. And then when I saw the write-up that looks like it's going to make it on the magazine for this next issue, I thought, wow, this is cool. It had an Italian spin on it, but it wasn't. It was true, and so there, it just helped bring things together for me. And I'll tell you what it was. I've told bits and pieces of this story all my life, actually, but never quite this way. And in the shows that I've done singing, I have always sung the song Santa Lucia, or almost always. And it was a song that I remember fondly, my father taking me outside, walking by the ocean where we lived, holding my hand. And I go into this when I'm doing the shows, and I tell people the experience that I was having while my father was teaching me this song, Santa Lucia. And it's interesting because I didn't realize it until today how this song has followed me up until now, and how it has almost defined some of my work today on this very show. See, because my father was big on not teaching me how to sing. He actually didn't think I had a good voice, which is a whole nother story. So he wasn't intent on teaching me to be a good singer. What was most important to him was for him to teach me the culture, for him to teach me the feeling of the songs, for him to teach me what the words meant, what the author was thinking and feeling, or what they wanted to convey while he was writing these words, and what the musician composer was thinking and feeling, and what they wanted to convey if it was two different people. So some of my fondest memories were to sit with my father and listen to opera, for example, and him explain the feeling of what was going on. And it was interesting because he said, whenever you sing Santa Lucia or any other Italian song that I later learned on my own, or he even taught me as well, or I heard him sing and learned from him, it was always the feeling that we were going after. What do you feel while you're singing this? What do you think somebody listening to this song feels? And it wasn't until years later when I started singing professionally that people started coming up and telling me something that I didn't understand at the time. Wow, I feel so happy when I come to your shows. And I thought that was the oddest thing. And I would say, I wonder if they like my song selection. I wonder if they like my stories, because I used to tell, and sometimes still do, humorous stories. I never really made the connection. And I would hear that a lot. People would say, oh, that's the best show I've ever seen. And I'd think, don't these people get out? It was just me and the piano or me and a small band. And how could this be the best show? And what's happening to them? And so it wasn't until I actually left singing for a few years and I started doing the radio show with Chef Richard Lombardi, my co-host on the Filippo and the Chef show. And I was doing that, and a couple years into it, I did an interview with an older gentleman, and actually two interviews really stand at the top of my mind when it comes to this particular story. And both of them said something similar, how happy they were at the end of the interview. And both of them obviously started the interview, obvious to me, in a little bit disgruntled state because of various reasons, individual to each other. But they were happy at the end of the interview. And I remember asking one of them point blank, why? Why would you say that? Why do you feel happy now? And I remember them both looking at me and saying in different ways, you really don't know? And I said, no. As a matter of fact, one of them took the conversation into something completely different that he was having so much fun talking about. And I said to him, why did you take the conversation there? I didn't ask you that question. And he says, you really don't know. And I said, no, I don't know. And he says, it's you. You may have been asking a question out loud, but inside, you were asking a different question. And I was saying, what question could that have been that made you go there? And he said, don't you see that you wanted me to be successful in this interview? Don't you see that you wanted to bring out the best of me? Don't you see that you were really happy to be here with me, interviewing me? And I said, of course, but that doesn't answer my question. He said, yes, it does. He said, you took me to my happy place. And I started talking about things that make me happy. And the other person, I was a director, and he had been interviewed by many interviewers throughout Europe and had won awards for his movies. And I said, certainly, you've been interviewed by a lot of people. What, you must not say this all the time. And he said, no, this is the first and only time I've said this. And I said, so I'm new at this. What makes this so special for you? And he said, you weren't trying to trip me up. You weren't trying to find an angle that was making me look bad. Or he said, what I felt from you was you were trying to make me look good at every question you asked and every answer I gave. And I can almost get emotional right now because it's still something that I'm learning and I'm still trying to understand what really all is going on, because obviously there's more than what meets the eye. Because even as I'm doing the show, I'm trying to do a really good show here. And as with our next guest, I met with him. I spent time going over his book and the magazine articles written about him. I'm trying to get all the right questions. And yet people say to me, it has nothing to do with that. And I'm thinking, I'm working hard here. What do you mean it has nothing to do with that? And so it was interesting that this should come up just this weekend, because I have a feeling that as Johnny is listening, the guest for today is listening to the show now, he is going to have a lot to say about this. And it came up because of this interview for Amici magazine, and I can't wait to see what they do with it and to read it. And I'm very grateful for them having wanted to do this news story on me, and also for getting this information out of me to help me start to look at and help me change the way I look at what we're doing, what I'm doing, and what's really going on when I'm doing a show or singing a song or doing an interview. So it's interesting, my dad starting with teaching me Santa Lucia and wanting me to feel the song, and here I am years later wanting to feel the other person that I'm interviewing and help the audience feel the interaction, feel the emotions, and feel the sensitivity. And no wonder that we say you've never felt a radio show like this before. We just put that up because it felt right to say that, because we're all about feeling. And evidently, we're more about feeling than I even realized. So with that, I'd like to tell you what I'm feeling about our next guest, or rather, what I know. Let's start off with that. He actually was born with the affliction of autism. And yet, this is amazing to me, because we're talking about the stereotypical kind of autism, the withdrawn child, the rocking back and forth, the banging of the head against the wall or the bedpost, until basically he put a hole through it on more than one occasion. So he wanted minimal interaction with people and didn't know how to react with them when he did have interaction. But he was determined to be highly functional in our world, so to speak. He not only became highly functional, he became an accomplished professional ballet dancer. He became a professional mime and actually studied with Marcel Marceau. He became a martial artist, a lecturer, not only a life coach, but a teacher of life coaches, and an author. And he has authored the book Biotyping Beyond Body Language. So as a way of coping, living in our, quote, normal world, he developed this biotyping, which is something that we'll talk about in a moment here. But the interesting thing is that he developed that to help him cope with us in our normal world. And yet now he's using that to help us, quote unquote, normal people figure out our world. He will change the way we look at the way we literally move in our world. I welcome to the show Mr. Johnny Sykes.
Hey, Filippo, it's good to be here with you.
It's good to be here with you, too. Let me have you move a little bit closer to the microphone. And I have to tell everybody that I walked into Johnny's office, and the first thing he does is he gave me a hug, and then he said, "Walk for me." And I thought that was a little bit odd, but I did. I walked for him, and he said, "You were raised this way, and you think this way, and you do things this way." And I said, "Wow, how could you know that just from my walking?" And then he says, "Now sit on the floor and stand for me." And I did. And then he told me even more things. And he had names for the way I stood up and the way I walked. And is this the biotyping thing that we're going to get into in a little bit?
Yes, it is. I didn't really realize that it was a thing. When I was writing the book, I was talking about what I see when I look at people. And I said something to my wife about, "Well, you're a railroad person, so naturally you'd look at it that way." And she said, "What do you mean a railroad person?"
A railroad person?
Yeah.
Railroad.
I'm face blind, so I don't remember people. I've been in the room with two, what I'm told, are absolutely identical twins, and I saw no resemblance. So when I would meet people as a child, and today at 59 years old, I can't tell faces apart. I'm constantly meeting people, and they're saying, "Hey, Johnny, how you doing?" I'm fine. Who are you? I'm a student of yours. Oh, right. So being born face blind, the part of my brain that should look at faces and remember them doesn't. Most people can hold 2 million faces in that place in their brain forever. I look at a movie and my wife wants to kick me because I'm, "Honey, is that the wife or the daughter?" "It's the daughter. Shut up."
You know, Johnny, I'm laughing, and it's so good to be able to laugh with you here, because you have such an approach to all of this. I mean, as a child, I know from what you've shared, what I've read, that this wasn't the easiest thing to deal with. And it's still not. And yet you have completely turned it around to where, in talking to you, it almost feels like we're the ones that are not normal.
Well, it's kind of tough when you're born like a... There's a book called The Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, and this child grows up on another planet and he's never met a human being, but he looks like one, so everyone assumes he is a human being, and they do things like laugh, and he doesn't understand what's wrong with them. I've always felt like a stranger in a strange land. I've got the same everything that you do, except my head sees absolutely a different world. my mind processes things in a totally different way. I miss all kinds of social cues. So you'll be tapping your foot and pointing at your wristwatch, and I'll be chatting away. But I can't block out the pain I see in your heart. I can't block out the anger I see in your legs. I can't block out the fact that you desperately need to be touched. And I'm like an animal in that I see the energy, just not the clothes, the face, and the hair. And I had to learn a whole different way of interacting with people so they first didn't get mad at me. And I was a very irritating child.
But not by intention, that's the thing.
No.
Because you spoke in a way that was different. You understood the world in a way that was different than everybody else.
I see things differently. There's another autistic woman I get to lecture with sometimes named Temple Grandin.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a book called... what the Dickens was the name of that book, honey?
Animals
in Translation.
Right, because she works with cows. And when he says, honey, he wasn't talking to me. He was talking to his wife, who's also in the room, and that is Chris, and we're happy to have her here as well. So back to Templeton Grandin.
Temple was a classic autistic child like me. She was we both should have been locked up, but most classic autistic kids, or a lot of them, do get institutionalized.
Now, you don't mean that you should have been. And under normal circumstances, quote-unquote normal, a child like you would have been.
Chris could probably give you the statistics on it, but an awful lot of children who bang their heads, go downstairs and break every dish in the kitchen at night, who throw themselves violently against walls, tend to get a bad reputation, and people have a hard time figuring out what to do with them.
Well, before we go on, why do you think you were doing that? I mean, is that autism that makes you do something another child wouldn't, or?
I always felt that it rounded out the hard edges in life. Smacking my head against a wall or pounding against a chair held me in, contained me, made me feel safe. I mean, at 59, I still sleep with a 40-pound heavy blanket to make me feel safe. I wear tight belts. Autistic people don't like to be in crowds because we pick up way too much information. They say that autistic people don't feel. They say that we lack empathy. It's not that I have no feelings. I have too many, and I don't know what to deal with them. How to process them, how to... neurotypicals are sit there talking like nothing is going on, and I'm seeing the rage in someone's brain, I'm seeing the sadness in someone's heart, and they're talking about the weather, and I'm like, wait, there's something else going on, or I'll see things that others miss. Imagine a child, sweet little kid, looks normal, and says, Father Ed, why do you want to touch my booty? You little rat, what the heck are you talking? And then Father Ed gets moved to another parish because... he did touch somebody's booty. I would see these things, and I couldn't ignore them. And when I would talk about them, people got mad. People didn't want to hear it. People didn't want me around.
And when you say you would see them, you wouldn't actually see it physically happening, that you could just sense that this was...
I could see the bodies. At one time, I was talking about what I do with a group of people, and a guy comes up, what do you see? What do you see when you look at me? And after saying, I hate it when people do this, but... you carry a gun on your right hip and you miss it. And he said, God, how'd you know that? I'm an off-duty cop. And I said, because your hand has got this unnecessary tension that's kind of hovering around so that part of your body. I can't tune that out. Because I miss the faces that everyone else stares at, I see the neuromusculature in the body. And we don't like the term idiot savant, but I do have a little bit of a savant thing that I can literally... see every muscle and bone in a person's body, which ones are moving, which ones are blocked, which ones are packing extra energy, which ones are having no feeling whatsoever. I teach at a college of psychology because my wife, when she was getting her master's in psychology, they were talking about autism, and they said, autism is this. And my wife said, oh, I'm married to an autistic man. And they said, could you bring it in? We'd like to see one.
Oh, no.
And it's called a pervasive developmental delay, or retarded development, or retard. And they took me to a hypnosis class where the teacher put each student into a trance And then he would let the different students, while he was in, the person was in a trance, ask questions. And I'd look at him when it got to be my turn, and I'd say, what is it about your left hand and your brother's death? And the guy would, like, break open like a watermelon and start crying. And the guy would say, how do you do that? And I'm like, how could you miss it? He's screaming at me so loud I can't see anything else. And all you see is the shirt he's wearing and the expression on his face. But since I can't see the expression, all I'm left with is all I can't hide from.
You know, now when Johnny was trying to explain this to me in his studio, I came up with this analogy that worked for me, and I think women would relate to this even more than most men. But sometimes, like, you'll say to a woman, or I hear men say to a woman, why do you think that guy's cute, or something like that. And according to all rules of society, that man would be good looking. But to a lot of women, the answer was no. And he'd, you know, you'd hear my friends or whatever, even me, say, why is he not good looking? Well, because he looks like he's a womanizer, or he looks like he, you know,
has sharp edges that make me feel unsafe.
Right. So the woman isn't just looking at the physical beauty. She's not looking at the just the face. She's looking at behind, what's behind the eyes, or what kind of a provider would he be? What kind of a lover would he be? Where the men, you know, most men, we might, you know, say, oh, there's, I want that, you know, and it's more of a, more of a face value kind of thing. So you see somebody and you take it many steps further. You see way beyond all of the
well,
physical.
If you think that a woman is by nature smaller, less able to protect themselves, less mass and more vulnerable, quadruple that and you've got me. I feel so. In New York, we'd walk down the street, and I said, "Chris, I can't take this. The depression on the street is too heavy. I can't handle this." Or going out in the crowd, I'm just overloaded by what I pick up, and it's just a pure gift of the universe that I found a place where this gift is not a curse. It's actually something useful and wonderful that I can do with people.
Right. And before you go into that, you mentioned Temple Grandin. I just wanted to know what the connection you wanted to make with.
Oh, Temple, it designed more than 80% of the cattle handling facilities in the entire world because she understands cows better than anyone alive. She knows what they feel, what makes them comfortable, what makes them feel unsafe. I understand neurotypicals, is what I call you guys, human beings better than you guys understand yourself. Possibly because I'm on the outside trying to figure out how to safely interact in your world. I have a piece that called God Does Not Make Garbage, which is on the internet now. And my wife and I do it at autism conferences all over the world. And it starts out with me on a tightrope. And
is that the mind piece that I saw? Oh, okay, right.
My feeling of my whole life is that I live in this lockup in the top of a castle, and I'm allowed down where the people are eating and talking until I screw up, and then I'm locked back up again. And I feel like I spend my whole life trying not to mess up, not to say the wrong thing, not to just plain get in trouble and get put aside and yelled at again. And I spent so many years trying to figure out how to navigate neurotypical waters, being with people and not saying things that no one else would say. It's obvious as heck, but no one's acknowledging it, or not saying, you know, to someone, yeah, nice body, you don't say that. What do you say? Lovely hair. And I'm like, why are you lying? And to me, neurotypicals are constantly afraid to be who they are and afraid to show what they're feeling, what they're scared. Since that's all I see, and they come to my studio and I say, it's okay. Don't feel sad. I can see it in your... And they're like, oh my God, you see it? Yeah, kind of loudly. And it makes it okay for them.
So basically, are you saying that your quote-unquote affliction is, maybe there are other things involved, but if we were without inhibition, you're getting excited about that. Okay, it'd be a nicer world. Okay, so if we were without inhibition and without fear of saying the wrong thing, and if we were present at all times, then we would be like you.
Let me put it this way. If you stop right now and listen to your head, I'm told everybody has a committee in their head, mom saying, dude, look at your hair, your boss, your father. My head's dead silent. I have no sound, no voices in my head whatsoever. They've actually hooked me up to biofeedback machines, and all my brain waves live entirely in theta.
And now theta is where we like to take ourselves by going into meditation. And so this is you're always in a meditative state then.
I guess you call it that. To me, it's the only place I've ever lived, so I have no sense of time. Tomorrow and 10 years ago, yesterday and 10 years ago are exactly identical to me. I have no sense of time. I have no sense of... I get lost on my way home as often as not. But I see people with the intensity of somebody with the first night with a new lover or in a death match against an opponent. I see with that intensity and that immediacy, and there are no judgments, no voices, no things going on in my head except you and what you're feeling and me listening and being, and either being scared and wanting me safe or me wanting to say, it's okay, you can let that tension go. And I guess my work is that the savant part of me understands the physiology of the human body to the point where I teach doctors, I teach psychotherapists. I'm actually on the faculty at the College of Psychotherapy where they wanted to look at it.
Interesting.
Teaching psychotherapists to see what I see and teaching them how to prepare the body to handle what's hidden from them. So if it's in your subconscious, you've got a trauma that's unresolved. I see the trauma, and instead of addressing the trauma, I address how would the body have to prepare the core to feel safe enough and strong enough to handle a big heavy weight or handle dealing with a physical object. And when the body learns that, all of a sudden, the psychic wraps itself around the ability to feel okay to let it come up. I work with stroke survivors.
Right. Actually, before we get into the actual, because that's a whole other, that's great, actually, and we want to get into that. But before we do, do you think you've learned this because you're autistic or because of all the things that you've done, the ballet, the miming, the coping mechanisms that you've had to create? I mean, not all people that are afflicted with autism know this, correct?
Well, no, but think of it this way. I'm writing a second book that's about getting in touch with the resources that the human body has. You take a normal child, you throw him a ball, he catches it and throws it back, and it becomes an interactive conversation. You throw a ball to an autistic kid, he takes the ball and leaves the room, thank you. It doesn't occur to the autistic child to interact with the person that threw the ball.
Hmm.
I had to learn games. I had to learn physical interactions, emotional interactions, step by laborious step. So I learned it a whole lot better than most people. I'm a professional ballet dancer, but it took me three times as long as anybody else to learn the choreography. But by the time I got it, I understood much more about it than the person teaching it knew they were teaching.
You know, this is interesting, actually fascinating to me, because I studied opera. And so I went through many teachers, opera teachers, to help me. And I remember going to a very famous teacher who was a famous singer and a famous teacher and used to teach at one of the big universities. And she charged a lot of money, and she only accepted a handful of students every year, and she accepted me. But a few months after having accepted me, she threw me out. She said, "You've got a beautiful voice, but you will never learn how to sing." And the interesting thing is that she was, well, before I say that, then I immediately after her, I found a man who didn't have a good voice, who was not a famous singer, but was a well-known teacher in Hollywood. And I went to him, and he started teaching me how to sing. And what I found, what I came to learn, is that the previous teacher, she became famous as a singer. She was born with the natural ability to sing. She had no idea how to teach someone who didn't or wasn't born with that. And the other teacher couldn't sing very well, but he had to work hard at every note that he was able to finally sing someday.
Uh-huh.
And he was able to teach me how to be able to sing and bring out what I naturally had. And here you are. You are like him.
I had to work a whole lot harder at...
to learn how to be human, so to speak.
To learn how to look like a human being and to operate in the world of human beings and accept the fact that I would never be like others, but that what I had turned out to be a gift that could help others.
And so now you are helping us saying, I know what you're trying to do, and that's not the way you do it. This is the way.
Well, most of what I do, I'll put people on an unstable platform.
Like you did me.
Like I did you.
And I fell off.
And then I say, no, don't you know you've got this? Push your legs this way, do that, and all of a sudden there you are. Hey, this is easy. Most of what I do is so elementary that people disregard it. I often say, how do you make a soldier out of a raw recruit in 6 weeks flat? And everyone says, oh, you break them into small. No. As soon as you make a restricted exhalation, the transverse abdominis, most external abdominal muscle in the body engages, and that kicks in 100 muscles up and down the spine called the multifidus. And when that happens, the spine suddenly feels strong and ready to handle. The soldier doesn't say, okay, listen, I'm going to yell at you, and you yell back, sir, yes, sir. But that's basically how they initiate those muscles to kicking in. And people forget that when they get scared or mad, they make a s or a f sound. Think of your favorite four-letter expletive. And it's exactly the same as, sir, yes, sir, in the engagement of those muscles. So with a stroke survivor, I'll tell somebody, go, shh, and you add your own last two letters. And they're on their feet saying, how'd that happen? I said, your legs always had the strength. Your spine turned off that strength because it was afraid of getting hurt. But the second your spine felt able to handle it, boom, you're standing. If you have a trauma, a PTSD situation in your past, if you can't face it, your mind denies that it exists. But the second the core physically remembers that it's strong and can handle the stress, then all of a sudden your mind remembers it and is able to process it. I teach therapists how to prepare the body. I think, why did God give you a body that starts out beautiful, young, strong, great eyesight, great hearing, and then over the next 50, 60 years takes away your sight, takes away your strength, takes away your hearing? I tell people it's because our bodies are like a book. We've got a date tattooed on the inside of our left butt cheek. We can't read it, but it's the due date when the book is due back at the big library, and it has all these great lessons to teach us before we are done with it, so that by the time our eyes don't work so good anymore, we learn to really see other people. When our ears don't work so good, we learn to really listen. And the modalities for handling stress first get discovered physically in play, in climbing things, in childhood, and then they enable the body to feel safe enough to handle stress, and the mind says, wow, let me try that. And, for example, if you lock your knees, you cannot have authority in your voice with your knees bent. And the second you lock your knees, something happens both to you and your feeling of groundedness and in the person you're talking to. They respond instinctively and say, how'd that happen? I discovered this. I was a personal trainer teaching people how to handle physical weight, stress, and how to find balance. And their lives started to shift, and they said, what did you do to me? He says, I don't know. I taught you how to do this, and your body got it, but it seems like your body took it and applied it to your life. And as I watched it happen, I became aware that you teach the body how to handle stress and how to find balance, and immediately the mind and the consciousness apply that and starts to shift your whole life. So in my studio, all I do is give people physical challenges. Okay, soldier, I'm going to yell and scream at you. You yell back, sir, yes, sir, at me. And at the end of 6 weeks, the soldier's like, sir, are you done yelling? Because I'm sick of listening. Sir! I give a challenge, and like I did with you on that earthquake, that unstable surface, a suggestion. Your body said, okay, I got it. And like a soldier says, we're grunts, we can take it. Your body says, oh, wait, I can do this. Hey, let's try something tougher. I'm good at this. And so it's redefining the experience of being you on the most primal level. You could go to a psychotherapist. And I always, at the college, I'll say, what do you call a man who hates women? Oh, misogynist. What do you call a woman who hates men? There is no word. So I'm going to go to talk therapy that doesn't have words for a lot of the feelings that are hurting me. Mm-hmm. I go straight to the body from before there were words and teach the body to handle stress, to re-identify as being good at having balance, and all of a sudden that transfers into people's lives. And it may have taken me 3 times as long as it took you to learn these lessons, but now I can see how to help people experience them in their own body, and their life just follows
It's fascinating what you can do, and you've had so much success with so many people with various illnesses, not just the people that want to change their life, but the people that have no choice. Like you were on the cover of Stroke Connection magazine, A Man with a Gift, How Johnny Seat's Special Abilities Helped Dick Clark Recover, and you're still working with him. I know you worked with him today. What is it that... What's the first thing you start everybody off with?
With a stroke survivor, generally you're looking at one hemisphere of the brain crashed. The left hemisphere affects the right side of the body. The left hemisphere also deals with swallowing, speech, and other things. Or if it's a right hemisphere stroke, it affects the left side of the body. So one of the first things I work with is unilateral adduction, the ability to pull the thighs together, and finding what muscles are not firing and what compensation mechanisms the body is using to just be able to stand, to just be able to walk. And because I understand the physiology of what has to happen to make a person able to, I start with the core, and with the like the military sound, I get the core to stabilize itself so that it can feel confident to let the power of the legs kick in, and then I work at getting the right neuroimpulse to the body part, so that, you know, most people when they approach stroke, they say, okay, lift your leg, advance your foot, put your weight down. And I don't say that. I give a person instead of, I'll tell somebody, lift your leg, and they'll say, I can't, I had a stroke, idiot. And I'll put my chin above their knee, and I'll be real obnoxious, and I say, wouldn't you like to rot in a kisser? And boom, up comes the knee, and they say, how the heck did you do that? I gave your mind a picture. It figured out what to use, what resources were available. It did it. The body to survive will do phenomenal things. I just help the body to remember.
So basically, you reminded me of a phrase when you say somebody has no spine.
Uh-huh.
And that's the core that you're talking about. And what you're doing is you're helping build that spine, build that core.
Everybody has a spine, but an awful lot of people have not learned that by innervating certain muscles, they can handle. It's a very common experience that I take people who... I'll put my hand on their chest and I'll push and they'll roll backwards and say, whoa. And I'll say, do it again, but go, and I'll push and they're solid as a rock. And they say, how the heck did that happen? What did you do? Now, I can explain in detail the mechanics involved, but who cares? Nobody, once they discover a muscle, is going to turn it off and forget it. They're going to say, hey, let me try this again at home. Hey, I like this. And pretty soon they start applying it in every area of their lives. And it just... it's a self-evolving thing. It's amazing how many people can't walk on one foot, staying on one foot, and then the other foot. They don't realize that they're in a constant state of shambling or stumbling from foot to foot. And I get them standing on one foot on an unstable platform saying, oh, my God, this is good. I like this. I can handle this. Let me try something harder. And pretty soon, they're the ones who are directing the course of study, not me.
See, so the
it's all in. It's like ragu spaghetti sauce. It's in there.
And that's what I'm getting at is that, you know, there are people that have no spine. There are people that have...
They have a spine. They just lack the neuromuscular to stabilize it in the face of stress.
And I mean it figuratively, absolutely, like you're saying. And then people that don't have a strong footing, people that can't stand on their feet, you know. So this is what you're talking about, that aren't walking on solid ground. This is...
psychologically... if somebody has, as a child, always felt the earth was going to give out from under them, that something happened, and when they went to their parents said, it didn't happen, now stop it. Ha! They carry that experience into everything they do, expecting the earth to not be stable. And there's something called the mirror neuron, where the muscles, to prepare them to fall, engage, and guess what? Their body is already taking them off of a stable platform because they anticipate it not being stable. We manifest outside of ourselves what we expect. I work with a lot of doctors. I do a master class for practitioners. And I say, we don't believe what we see. We see what we believe. Looking at a client or looking at a situation, if we believe that we can't trust the earth, we'll prove it.
So you, in the book Biotyping, you've identified three types of people. And tell us what they are.
Okay. First one is a backward faller, what I call a railroad person.
Okay, so a backward faller you call a railroad person. Okay,
because they proceed step by step, pulling themselves toward a goal. Then there's a forward faller like me, who's constantly just falling forward, and a foot keeps showing up, So when I went to my wife and I said, hey, let's build this tower in the jungle like 60 feet high so we can see the river, and she says, where are you going to get the wood? You don't like my idea. Yeah, I do. Where are you going to get the money? You hate my idea. No, that's how she thinks, step by step. Me, I just charge and barge and figure from my experience of a foot always showing up that I'll find the wood. But to learn to communicate with her, I had to learn her language.
Is there? But
the third one
is it in the middle? The third one is in the middle?
The third one is David Letterman, Jay Leno, Bill Clinton. They're children who got to their feet under duress. Think of kids in the barrio standing with their feet really wide. You're not pushing me over, buddy. These are kids who grew up feeling like they had to fight, and Bill Clinton had an alcoholic mother. People who felt, we respond to our environment as children. The body's only got so many possible ways to get to your feet, and we choose the one that's most consistent with how we see ourselves in life. And I figured that, I found that there are only three, and everyone in the world, I've been in the deepest jungles in Peru and seen one torso sway walker, one backward faller, and one forward faller walking naked with some dead monkeys they had just hunted.
Mm-hmm.
It's the world over. There are only so many ways to get to your feet, and everybody in the world falls into one of them. And there's a bio-personality, as in how you approach and handle problems. And there's a bio-psychology, because how you do it with your body becomes how you do it with your mind and your emotions. And when I was able to extrapolate which person I was talking to, I could change to their language. And no one's ever noticed this before. We go to an exercise class, and 12 people are doing sit-ups bending from a different place, one from the waist, one from the hips, and nobody notices it. I see it, and I realize that they're different body types. So I'm able to say, okay, try this. And all of a sudden, oh, my God, that worked. Because I know what their body needs to do to be able to handle any given challenge.
And it does seem to work by all the testimonials and all the people that I know that have experienced you. And actually, you come to us through our friend Janet Bagumian. So we're really happy that she brought you to us. And I am going to come and experience more of what you do.
Yeah.
I will, and I look forward to it. But in the meantime, for people that don't know and want to know more about you, how do they find you? You're on the internet now.
You can go to biotyping.com, biotyping.
Uh-huh.
And there's bunches and bunches of stuff. They can YouTube The Stroke Whisperer and see me working with stroke survivors. They can also, on YouTube, look up God Does Not Make Garbage, which is the mime performance that my wife and I do at autism conferences.
Right.
And
is that on your website at biotyping.com?
Not yet. I'm not smart enough to get my change my web.
I think you're plenty smart. Biotyping.com, biotyping.com.
Or just Google Johnny Seitz and you'll get more than you want.
Did you want me to give the number here?
Sure.
Because you have a studio called Axis Evolving, which is a great name. 310-714-5222. Johnny, you know, when you said that when I was at the studio, I might have been looking at my watch or tapping my feet ready to go, and you wouldn't have noticed it, but I can assure you I wasn't doing that. And both of us did have an appointment right after, though, so we did end up having to cut our time short. And just like here again, we have to cut our time about now because we have some other segments to do before the end of the show. But I could listen to you and play with you for hours. And I say play because not only are you fun, but you literally have what you call toys. I mean, they're tools, but your studio is full of what you call toys.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly looks fun in there, so I can't wait to come and play with you.
Yeah. Get ready to redefine yourself as someone who lives for stress because it's fun.
Oh.
And you're good at it.
Oh.
And who can balance phenomenally in every area of your life, because it's why the universe gave us a body to learn from. So read the darn book before you give it back to the big library.
Okay, well, actually, the book came from you, not the library, so can I keep it inside?
Yep.
And Johnny, thank you so much. You know, actually, I see your name spelled two different ways in too many...
Oh, they misspelled it on the cover of one of the magazines. It's S-E-I-T-Z.
Okay, so it is Seitz.
Seitz.
Okay, I was pronouncing correctly. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, Johnny Seitz, thank you so much for being with us on the show.
Well, stay a few minutes afterwards so that we can take pictures before you go, and I'd like to get to know your wife a little better as well. So thank you, Johnny.
Thank you.
Well, Johnny could certainly have been our luminary today because he has certainly helped a lot of people and done a lot of great things for the world in this new body typing that he's found. But we have here our producer, Mark Skelton, who has a different luminary.
Yes.
As worthy, I'm sure.
Johnny Sykes would have been a great luminary.
And he is.
But he did get a good session with you tonight. So we're going to give a call out to a very special guy. His name is Brad Blauser. Now, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. But he's actually an American guy who has been in Baghdad, Iraq, since 2005. He went there as a contractor and worked there for several years. And then last year, he decided to stay in Baghdad with no paycheck, thousands of miles from his family back here. And he basically has been manifesting wheelchairs for disabled children that have been affected by the war. And it's truly amazing. Like I say, he doesn't get paid, I mean, not in dollars anyway. And he has realized that there are so many children that are ignored. UNICEF actually did a study, and something like 1 in 7 children in Baghdad actually have a physical disability. So it's actually tying in quite nicely with tonight's show, because I'm sure Johnny would see all kinds of ways to fix that, you know, if he was over there. But this guy really is a luminary. He's doing this. He's working his service. He's working from his heart. And every week we bring up a new person, and obviously that's the common theme. And I was chatting to Dorothy earlier, actually, and we agreed on the definition of a luminary, and it's an ordinary person doing extraordinary things, and that's truly what this guy is doing. So thank you, Brad Blauser. You're doing amazing work, and if your family are listening to this, then, you know, just have peace of mind that he's doing amazing service for the planet. So that's our luminary.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Mark, for bringing that to us. Mark Skelton, everybody. And now we have our very own cosmic advisor, Dorothy Lee, with the State of the Universe address.
Hi. I've spoken to you often of the truth that tomorrow is what we believe, feel, think, say, and do today. Tonight I will share with you a very simple way of manifesting that which we desire and deserve to have as the divine children of God that we are. Since we are the co-creators of this thing called life, we can set our intentions each day by stating our hopes, dreams, and desires in a positive and affirmative way. Years ago, I put together a daily invocation, which, when incorporated into our daily lives, changes our lives dramatically. It is one of the easiest, most powerful, and most effective ways of utilizing the power of the law of attraction. All you need to do is read the invocation twice a day. Please read it out loud and always state that everything you have affirmed is in the highest and best good for all concerned. And now, just imagine what would happen if you clearly stated your intentions to the universe. By doing this, we easily put our attention on what is in our highest and best good. My daily prayer begins with an invocation and then states in a positive, affirmative manner all of the things I wish to become and those things I wish to manifest in my world. The affirmations come from several sources. I didn't know until many years after I wrote the invocation and daily prayer that a lot of the statements come from the movie and our book, The Secret. However, I purposely chose 7 of the affirmations from a really wonderful book titled The Traveler's Gift, 7 Decisions That Determine Personal Success by Andy Andrews, because of the power and the truth in them. And as I mentioned before, I close with Don Miguel Ruiz's 4 Agreements. The rest of the affirmations come from me and through me, from my guides. The first statement after the invocation is wonderful. I accept that I am the divine child of God. The man known to the world as Jesus told us that we are all children of God, but most religions do their best to separate us from Source. Once we accept that we too are God's children, then we can remember that we are powerful beyond measure and that with God all things are possible. A few of my favorite affirmations are, I love myself enough to always do the things I know I need to do. I always make the most elegant choices possible. It is safe for me to be healthy, happy, powerful, and abundant in all areas of my life, and I am healthy, happy, powerful, and abundant in all areas. I release all attachment to specific outcomes involving other people. Every day, in every way, my life is better and better and better. I know exactly what my mission and purpose is this lifetime, and I easily and effortlessly begin to do the work I've come to do. I earn large sums of money for doing the work that I have passion for and love. The prayer then ends with the four agreements and closes with this statement, all of this by divine right, divine intervention, and for the highest and best good for all concerned. Thank you, thank you, thank you, God, for everything in my life. You can find the entire invocation and daily prayer by going to our website, www.lifechangeswithfilippo.com, and click on to Life Changing Media in the navigation bar. I have shared this invocation with others for the past 10 years, and many have reported the miracles they've co-created by using this method to set their attention each day and to put their intentions out to the universe in a positive, affirmative manner. I trust that you will decide to do this simple exercise each day for yourself. Until next week, please choose to love yourself enough to make very conscious and elegant choices. And please know that you are loved. You are lovable, and you are loved.
Thank you, Dorothy Lee with the State of the Universe Address. And Dorothy, before you go, you and I have been joking around all week how we've been calling each other autistic because we do certain things that are wonderful things to do, and if Johnny does them, then we, you know, then it's a good thing. And so what did you think about the interview?
It was fantastic. It was fantastic. And I believe autism is a label that they put on people they don't know what else to do with. I find Johnny fascinating and his work amazing. And I have taken the test that he suggested to you when you interviewed him several times now. I'm very autistic.
I know you. I know, according to the test, you're not. But the funny thing is that you almost want to be. In the sense that Johnny said to me, you know, Johnny says, growing up, I had this experience and that experience, and I'd say, well, I had that experience too. And he says, well, maybe you're autistic. And he says, go to this website and take this test. And it's interesting because in so many ways, so many of us that have had to endure difficulties in our childhood that now are able to, let's say, cope in the real world, we have learned some coping mechanisms that actually are very helpful to, would be very helpful to everybody if they knew them. And the irony of it is, those that, let's say, led normal lives, had the perfect parents, had the perfect childhood, didn't get to learn some of these things through the difficulty. So that's why it's quite a confusing thing, if you ask me.
Well, it is confusing, and when I did take the test, Lipo, the first time it said they couldn't come to any conclusion because I had too many confusing answers to the control test, the control questions, and so I took it again, and it said I was not autistic, but I know that if you took the test and pretended to be me, it would turn out to be a different answer.
So you're saying we see each other in a different way.
Yes, we do.
Well, but the important thing here is that maybe there's a lot more to this than a test is able to say, and that a label is saying, and there's so much more behind this that needs to be explored, and it unfortunately the label makes it to seem something that it's bad, and surely it's not easy as for children growing up, but we certainly hope that there will be a way, and Johnny might lead the way here with helping people
Absolutely.
See that these children maybe have special, well, obviously have special gifts that the other children don't.
Absolutely. With Johnny out there, it would be an honor to be called autistic. So I think he's putting a whole new face on something, on a label that has been misinterpreted for a long, long time.
Well, this obviously
we really are grateful to you, Johnny.
Well, this obviously is something that we could be discussing for a long time, and we'll be discussing in the future with other shows on autism and having other people either with the affliction or that are working with it, because it's a very, very important topic, and we certainly haven't come to the bottom of this, but we're grateful that Johnny has brought us to this point as he has, with humor and love and joy, which I've never been able to talk about a subject like this with that much humor and love and understanding, and so I appreciate him bringing that out of me. And I am sorry to say that that's our show for today. I would like to go on and explore this even more, but we'll have to wait until next week. Again, we'd like to thank Johnny Seitz for being on our show today and invite you to learn more about him by going to our show archives on our website and clicking on the respective links for more information. You'll also get to hear the show again, if you'd like, on our website at LifeChangesWithFilippo.com. Now, we look forward to our next guest. Next week, we will have David Weddle. David is currently a writer and co-executive producer on CSI, the award-winning CSI, I should say, and the very popular. He has served as writer-producer for all four seasons of Battlestar Galactica, which, incidentally, was just named Program of the Year by the Television Critics Association just this past Saturday night. So congratulations to David Weddle and all the team there at Battlestar Galactica. He has also written for such shows as Star Trek Deep I should take that test now. Has written for such shows as Star Trek Deep Space Nine, The Twilight Zone, and Katie Sackhoff's first series, The Fearing Mind. So looking forward to having him on our next show. Can't wait to talk to him. Remember, you can keep the conversation going during the week by visiting us and writing us on our website at LifeChangesWithFilippo.com and connect with us at our Life Changes with Filippo Facebook fan page. For that matter, any of our personal fan pages. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems, Change Your Water, Change Your Life, and Love and Miracles. To learn more about them, visit our sponsor page on our website also and click on their links. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and it has been my pleasure being of service by hosting Life Changes with Filippo today. I, along with our hosts and our co-hosts and our producers, Dorothy Lee, Mark Skelton, and Mark Lejeur, and our engineer, Seth, thank you for joining us in being a part of this show and being a part of the change we all wish to see in the world. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here every Monday night at 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and visit us on the web at LifeChangesWithFilippo.com. That's Filippo, FILIPPO.com. And follow our community on Facebook at Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here next week as we graciously embrace the only constant, life changes.